We're here in the Their World exhibition booth at the World Humanitarian Summit, where there's a huge array of exhibitions to go and visit, and the Their World booth is displaying illustrations from children who are themselves refugees, where they've drawn for the charity what they think a safe school looks like.
So where are these children based? In which regions?
We've asked children from around the world, but children who are living, you know, a vulnerable existence, who are concerned about their chance to go to school, the quality of schooling they'll get, but also whether they have a safe journey to and from school, or whether the prospects of not going to school make them vulnerable to child labour, child trafficking for young girls, early marriage. So girls all over the world, and boys all over the world, yeah.
Did you get a chance to go to those locations and meet with them and talk to them directly?
I visited a number of different places. We were talking to children in Kenya who live and go to school inside that giant rubbish tip that is the Kibera slum, where there is such a vitality and an energy and a determination to learn, but also an awareness of the danger of their circumstances, and to make sure that girls going to and from their schools, you know, have a safe walkway and walk with each other and, you know, don't let themselves be out on their own. And also thinking of young boys and girls that I met who are Syrian refugees, and seeing them at the schools that they've been able to start at after a gap of some years in Lebanon, in a new home in Lebanon, and attending a double shift school where they're able to leave their home or their camp that they stay in, be able to get on a bus and travel to a school where they'll be either the morning shift or the afternoon shift and studying alongside local Lebanese children. So for them, their school is sometimes the simple frustration of sharing a coat peg with somebody else.
Now, only 2% of humanitarian aid reportedly goes to education. Are you here in order to try and get donors to provide more towards education?
This first ever World Humanitarian Summit represents a very valuable opportunity for education in emergencies. Education has for too long been left out of the humanitarian response equation and out of the budgets. 1 to 2% is the amount that's often allocated for education, but set against the need, the very great need for food, shelter, water, sanitation, emergency healthcare. So the call for education is one that's coming from those children themselves and their families, and saying that their absolute priority for themselves when their lives are disrupted and in chaos and often in extreme danger due to war or due to a natural emergency disaster, they want to return to a normality that involves going to school is paramount. So this is an opportunity to say there needs to be a greater allocation in the humanitarian funding, not just the wider development piece, but humanitarian funding for education, but not at the expense of all those other critical emergency services that are needed.
Now, would you say that here at the World Humanitarian Summit, the launch of this new fund is a first of its kind?
The Education Cannot Wait Fund is being launched at the World Humanitarian Summit and has the opportunity to collect up funding from all kinds of different sources. It's not just governments putting money into this fund, that will allow the next emergency or crisis that emerges to have education right at the forefront of that humanitarian response. And this is a really important shift. And while it will start small, it's going to gather pace and grow very quickly. And it will do so for a number of reasons. One is there's a huge interest. There's a real buzz at this summit that education has finally found its moments in the emergency piece, and a huge amount of interest. There's an awful lot of partners, governments, NGOs, other civil society organizations who are ready to help deliver that education, no matter the precariousness of the circumstances or how far children have had to travel to find a new temporary home and to be able to resume their schooling. So there's an energy for it. There's also a deep commitment to finding new funding for it.
Now, you work very closely with your husband, Gordon Brown, who we'll be speaking with tomorrow. Could you tell me why you make such a good team together?
I think I make a good team with my husband, Gordon, because we're a good team, you know, in our own personal lives, and we both share many of the same passions. Certainly the work he does is very different to mine. He's a politician. He works as an envoy for the United Nations Secretary General and is very engaged with the big global pieces, with the financing piece, and with how you engage in moving the political levers to make the big things happen. My role has been very much from the NGO side, working with a charity, mobilising and campaigns, working with youth voices is where I think we've found a lot of power through our charity side, and also looking at delivering small programmes on the ground to see what works and what doesn't work. So while we work in very different fields, I think that both Gordon and I share the same passions, and certainly it's somewhere where you come together at a World Humanitarian Summit, you can see that you're looking to make an impact for the same children.